world is room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate. We think too much and feel too little. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness. Without these qualities, life will be violent. No, will be lost.
It is Thursday, and it is June 4th, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola, and I am subbing for Clint Richardson on the Corporation Nation. Clint's websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. He is the producer of the wonderful video, the wonderful, it's just fabulous. Everybody should look at that video. More than once, actually. The Corporation Nation is also the producer of Lethal Injection, the story of vaccination, which came out in 2011. He also produced Kaffir School, School Districts, and The Lottery. One of his newest movies is Common Core, Agenda 21, and Global Privatization, which came out in December of 2013. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. We have two chat rooms open tonight, corporationnation.chatango.com and spingola.chatango.com. Now, earlier today, Chatango was not working very well, but hopefully it will work well for us tonight. You may also call into the program in the second hour at 800-313-9443 to talk about, hopefully about the things that I'm going to bring up tonight. RBN does have a tribute to the late, great Michael Collins Piper. It is up on the website, and last night we did devote the entire program to Michael Collins Piper. We had a lot of wonderful callers who called in with their experiences, and I believe that it was a very good program. A lot of people had a lot of really good things to say about him, and for that I am very grateful that that you participated. And anyway, Clint talks a lot about corporations, and that's what I started the week out Monday night talking about. And we did take just a quick break last night, and so I'm going to pick up where I left off, talking about corporations that are, well, that have a lot to do with our personal lives, with our health care, and things that we don't ordinarily hear about in the mainstream media. Or if we do hear about them, they are kind of bullet points, or they're presented in such a way that you really don't have enough time to get the full impact of the message, and they're usually biased towards the CDC, the FDA, and the authoritarian figures, like doctors. So, just tonight I was talking about the FDA, and I'm going to backtrack just a little bit, and back to 1992. Due to the pharmaceutical industry's criticism of the FDA's approval time for new drugs, and this is because of the FDA's lack of financial resources for adequate staff, Congress passed the PDUFA, which is a law that enables the FDA to enhance the time or speed up the time for new drug approval and to hire more staff. Now, a company that applies for FDA approval of its products must pay an application fee. Initially, this fee was $310,000 per drug, which the FDA utilized to increase its staff by 1,500 new drug industry paid employees. In other words, these paid employees were paid essentially by the drug industry, the very industry that the FDA is supposed to protect the citizens against. Now, a lot of people think that the FDA looks at everything that is produced by the various corporations, and that they are just this wonderful, wonderful organization that they look at everything to make sure that we're all safe. Not realizing that in order to get FDA approval, that a company, particularly the pharmaceutical industry, has to pay to get the drug approved, which presents a conflict of interest in and of itself. Okay, so because of this new law, the FDA were able to increase its staff by 1,500 new drug industry paid employees within 10 years. By 2004, the fee was $576,000 per drug, which obviously is a very high price, and which obviously a smaller company that might actually be more invested in helping an individual to stay healthy, well, they just can't afford it. So it's the big corporations that are going to have the money to pay these fees to the FDA. Now, the user fees soon accounted for approximately half of the FDA's evaluation budget. The fast-growing pharmaceutical industry, with its many chemical preparations, now subsidizes the FDA, the very agency that is supposed to be protecting the population. President George H.W. Bush signed this act into law on October 29, 1992. Which, of course, was right after NAFTA. I love timelines, and I'm always creating timelines so that people can see exactly what was happening when and what kind of coincided with some other event that is, well, that impacts everyone. And we have so many people in this country that actually thinks that certain events and certain other things really don't impact them, when every single law that is passed, particularly in the last, since 2001, every law that is passed, particularly, well, after the so-called Patriot Act was formed, they think that, well, it doesn't have anything to do with me. It does. Everything has to do with everyone. Okay? Even if you don't think it does. Now, in 2005, the FDA increased its user fees to $295 million. 55%, and this is the total fees, 55% of the new employees were in positions where they would review new drug approvals. Since the law was enacted, the industry has pulled only 13 prescription drugs from the market following the deaths of hundreds of people. Now, of course, all these drugs were quickly taken to market. They weren't actually, well, they were rubber stamped. Most of the clinical all of the clinical trials are done by the drug companies themselves. And so they present clinical trials to the FDA, and the FDA is supposed to evaluate the clinical trials, but more often than not, they simply rubber stamp things and, well, a lot of people die. And often they do not attribute their deaths to their prescription drugs, because they have learned, we've all been indoctrinated to believe that doctors would never give us anything that would harm us. That is just not the case. In a Los Angeles Times article, David Willman revealed the resulting problems associated with that law, the PDUFA, and this law also allowed for the approval of 20% more drugs within 3 years. There was also a simultaneous increase in the FDA approval of harmful drugs because of all this rubber stamping. From January 1993, to December 2000, drug companies actually introduced 7 highly lethal drugs, but they soon withdrew those drugs following their connection to at least 1,002 deaths. Those are just the confirmed deaths. Many people, as I said, many people may have perished without recognizing the causal association to the drugs, because people think, well, I was on this medication, but gosh, the disease got to me, and, or their relatives say, well, they were on this great medication, but I guess it just didn't help. I guess their disease was either too far advanced or something. We just don't know what happened, but our poor relative died. And remember that only about 1% of the population actually report to any government agency their adverse drug reaction, because they simply do not believe that the FDA or the United States government, and the FDA is an agency of the United States government, they just simply do not believe that the United States government would do anything to hurt the population. Oh boy. In August 2001, Willman reported that companies had withdrawn a dozen lethal drugs since September 1997. That's a 4-year period, 9 of which the FDA approved after 1993. They included a diet pill, a medicine for heartburn, and an antibiotic, all of them dangerous. In fact, most antibiotics are incredibly dangerous. They kill most of the good gut bacteria and present an opportunity for you to get some really, really serious problems in your gut. And even the heartburn medications, usually people do not have enough acidic acid in their stomach to digest their food. They don't need a medicine for heartburn. They need more of the natural digestive action, acids in their tummy. And this is particularly true as you grow older. Now, I'm not a doctor. I've never played a doctor on television. I've just done a great deal of research and have tried to find the people and do the research with people who present facts and figures, not just opinions. Keep in mind that opinions are not and never have been facts. Okay, George Keyworth, Reagan's science advisor, initiated the idea of this technology transfer to private business entities, what amounts to the commercialization of the people's health. And any time that you commercialize a person's health or commercialize anything, you know that it's going to be the big corporations that are going to step in and make boatloads of money, which isn't good for the population. In 1984, private firms invested $26 million into university research budgets. By 2000, just 16 years later, they invested $2.3 billion, an increase of 9,000%. This money came at a time when the cost of medical research was rapidly increasing. Now, on Tuesday night, I mentioned the Bayh-Dole Act, and this act created a burgeoning alliance between academics that should have been objective and scientific and the insensitive pharmaceutical industry, whose goal, whose main objective is to make an ungodly amount of profit. The pharmaceutical industry is there to make profit. Doctors are in business to not cure you, but to treat you with the products from the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, you will never find a doctor who will say, this medication will cure you. They always say, okay, let's treat this malady with this drug. Okay? In fact, they're not supposed to say cure. Now, during Reagan's administration, and this was also, it was also during Reagan's administration that the number of media corporations decreased dramatically. And this is altogether another topic. But there were a lot of things during his administration that changed dramatically. During his administration, federal research grants decreased while the privatization of research funding increased. Drug companies then began to fund most of the research and the clinical trials. The Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research, the AHCPR, stated that a drug company funded 315 clinical trials of 29 antidepressant drugs. The drug companies were naturally not going to discover the fact that talk therapy is much more effective than medication. Congress passed the Drug Price Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act, sponsored by Senator Orrin Hatch and Representative Henry Waxman, which took effect on September 24th, 1984. Their alleged objectives were to encourage the struggling generic drug industry while also extending more exclusivity to the brand name drugs to compensate for the lengthy FDA approval times. The law, as I indicated, streamlined the FDA approval procedure for generic firms who did not have to clinically test their drugs. In other words, if the drug companies, the generic drugs, had the very same ingredients and did the very same things as the brand name drugs did, then they did not have to go through any drug testing. All they had to do was say, okay, this generic drug is just like this brand name drug, so let's get it through. And so they didn't have to do any testing of their drugs at all. They just applied to the FDA, and that was all the evidence that their less expensive drugs, even though they supply, they had the same active ingredients as the previous tested brand name drugs, they reproduced and were bioequivalent to the patient. So, the industry also managed educational, quote unquote, crusades to increase public awareness. The law allowed the drug makers to fast track generic versions of brand name drugs without conducting costly and duplicative clinical trials. In 1985, the FDA announced that it was considering accepting clinical trials conducted in other countries as part of the new drug application. And so, let me just say this. Adverse reaction reporting is much lower in the European trials than in the same trials done in America. So, what the FDA was saying was, we're going to accept clinical trials from foreign drug companies, and we're just going to get everything passed that we possibly can by the FDA, and have more medication, both generic and brand names, available for the consumer who were now treated, treated by medications rather than having a lengthy conversation with your doctor and actually figuring out what was going on. It was just easier to have this, the protocols where if you go in with a certain set of symptoms, then you are going to be prescribed a certain drug. Okay, I'm going to quickly look in the chat room and see if there are any questions or comments. And the chat room is available. Both of them are open. Let me just open the other one because I actually just have Spingola.chatango open. So I am during the break going to open the other one. So anyway, it's a terrible situation that we find ourselves in. Now, after the passage of the Stevenson-Whittler Act, Congress passed the Federal Technology Transfer Act of 1986, effective October 20th, 1986. This law established the Federal Laboratory Consortium, another legislative vehicle for the transfer of technology from federal government agencies to the commercial sector. Okay, what I'm saying is that this consortium was paid for by the taxpayers. The federal government created it so that they could transfer technology to corporations. It enabled federal laboratories to enter into cooperative research and development agreements, the CRADAS, in order to negotiate licenses for patented inventions made at the laboratory. This and other legislation allows business to benefit from the commercial benefits without, in other words, the taxpayer pays for the development, pays for the research, the federal government hands it over to a corporation who then markets the drug or the apparatus or whatever, because now, as a partner, drug companies may exercise significant management over the manner in which the scientists conduct the research. Now, before the 1980s, drug companies, mostly led by chemists, encouraged the researchers they sponsored to work independently without pressure to develop innovative products. The drug companies did not interfere or fabricate data in the clinical trials. Then, after the introduction of the public-private partnership, the prospect of massive profits, companies became enmeshed with the research, often having a marketing expert collaborate with the so-called scientist on product research design along with the publication of the results. And of course, the industry, instead of using scientists, they put in place people who were corporate managers, people who had conducted, who were, well, corporation people, because it was the industry's objective was to develop very marketable products that would appeal to a large segment of the population rather than a small group of people with a particular illness. Now, if you have a relative or if you are suffering from some real illness, don't wait for any drug company to come along with a remedy, because if you're in a small group of people with this particular illness, it's not going to pay the drug companies to produce something just for a small group of people. So sponsors, instead of researchers, now direct the clinical trials. This power and greed initiated a massive expansion in industrial wealth and influence since 1980, along with increased medical cost. So in this country, we spend more on health care than any other country in the world. Yet we are the sickest country in the world, despite the fact that we spend the most money. And what's making us sick? And that's what we hope to kind of discover in our research. Drug companies, now led by profit-driven executives rather than chemists, control the research and concealed the inevitable lethal side effects. Now, keep in mind, every single drug, it doesn't matter whether you're trying to quit smoking, it doesn't matter what the drug is for, you have lethal side effects. Okay, we will be right back. Never see the end of the road while you're traveling with me. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for Clint Richardson, and I will be with you again tomorrow night. Anyway, would you please hold your calls until the second hour, and then I would be happy to take callers. Further, according to the adjudication of the Supreme Court, inventions no longer had to serve a practical purpose, or alternatively, a patent could be acquired for a previously non-patentable item if the applicant could justify a future practical purpose, such as in the plants or body parts, on the basis that the patent holder could alter or adapt the original genetic composition to create a beneficial end product. Given greater leniency by the USPTO and bonuses for the number of patents each examiner granted, Eli Lilly acquired two patents for Prozac, one for depression and another one for obesity. A company may now have several patents on the very same drug with, and I quote, new uses, dosage forms, and combinations of old drugs. Even the coatings and colors of pills can be patented. In other words, if you put out Prozac as a purple pill and it's for depression, you can put out the very, very same drug in a different color and it can be used for something else. And that is according to the Supreme Court. In 1987, due to industry influence, Congress passed legislation that prevents anyone other than the manufacturer from purchasing prescription drugs from other countries, even American-made, to block people from acquiring cheaper drugs from Canada. The 1997 Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act greatly benefited Big Pharma. It compelled the FDA to reduce its criterions for drug approval and the number of drug trials to as few as one. Most importantly, the FDA no longer required the drug companies to prove a new drug's efficacy over an older, often safer drug. The drug companies may, as a result of the law, may use placebos only to test against new drugs. This makes it possible for the drug companies to create more expensive copycat drugs rather than developing new beneficial, innovative drugs. In 1990, the top 10 drug companies spent about 11% of their sales revenue on research and development and 36% on marketing. Let me read that to you again. In 1990, the top 10 drug companies spent about 11% of their sales revenue on research and development and 36% on marketing. By 2000, the figure for marketing increased to 140%, I believe is what it should say. So keep in mind that in 1997, that the drug industry gained permission from the FDA to start advertising on television. In 1997, the National Bureau of Economic Research reported that publicly funded research was responsible for 15 out of the 21 most effective drugs approved between 1965 and 1992. In other words, the taxpayer is paid for 15 out of the 21 most effective drugs developed between those 27 years. Okay? And yet it's the drug companies that are making huge, huge revenues off of what the taxpayer has paid to do the research. The Boston Globe reviewed the 50 top-selling drugs approved between 1992 and 1997 and discovered that the government funded 45 of them. 45 out of 50 top-selling drugs were funded by the government. Publicly funded medical discoveries and academic researchers, rather than the pharmaceutical industry, are the key source and the driving force behind breakthrough drugs, or so-called breakthrough drugs. Now, let's backtrack a little bit here and see how this works. How the pharmaceutical industry and the government work together. It's quite a cozy cooperation, collaboration. Donald Rumsfeld headed Gilead Sciences from 1997 to 2001, a company that produced antiviral drugs to treat patients infected with HIV, hepatitis B, and influenza. In March 1999, Gilead acquired Nexstar Pharmaceuticals, whose two biggest revenue-generating drugs were AmBisome and Duanoxone, an oncology drug taken by HIV patients. Also, in 1999, and of course the whole idea of HIV and AIDS is altogether another story. But, I won't go into that now. But also in 1999, Roche announced the first approval of Tamiflu, which Gilead originally discovered and licensed to Roche for marketing. Rumsfeld, who held major stock in Gilead, left to become defense secretary from 2001 to 2006 under George W. Bush. In November 2005, Bush urged Congress to pass a $7.1 billion in emergency funding to prepare for the possible bird flu pandemic, of which the government dedicated $1 billion for the purchase and distribution of Tamiflu. Now, if that isn't conflict of interest, and certainly, it put a lot of money into Rumsfeld's pocket, and a lot of money into the pharmaceutical industry, which the taxpayers were paying for, and now the government could come along and say, okay, we've got to get all of you people inoculated or vaccinated. In October 2004, someone asked Bush, then running for his second term, if he was going to get a flu shot. And he responded, and I quote, "I haven't got a flu shot, and I don't intend to," unquote. Andreas Moritz asked the obvious question, and I quote, "Does Mr. Bush know more than the rest of us?" unquote. This is reminiscent of the attitudes evident at the Simpson-Wood Damage Control Consensus Conference, wherein dangerous drugs are good for the population, but not for the grandchildren of the people who participated in that secret conference. They were all a bunch of, people who work for the drug companies, people who work for the FDA, and those people that participate in the revolving door between the FDA, the CDC, and the drug industry. In 2003, Carl Elliott wrote, and I quote, In the past two decades, the United States has moved steadily towards a market-based healthcare system. In this system, the pharmaceutical industry has achieved unprecedented financial power. Since the early 1990s, the pharmaceutical industry has been the most profitable industry in America, with margins exceeding 18%. With profit has come power. In the 1999-2000 election cycle, the drug industry spent more money on political lobbying than any other industry. More than the oil and gas industry, more than tobacco, more than the insurance or automobile industry. The drug industry has also ratcheted up its spending on doctors. The number of drug representatives employed to make promotional pitches directly to doctors rose by 57% in the 1990s to a total of 88,000 by the end of the decade. Perhaps most remarkably, the drug industry now funds 40% of continuing medical education in American medical schools. In other words, that professor that's standing in front of all of those potential doctors is teaching those doctors what drugs they should prescribe for their patients. Fascinating, isn't it? Okay. We are coming, we're coming up on a break. We will take calls, as I mentioned, in the second hour. And let me just check in the chat room. It wasn't working a little bit ago, but hopefully it's working now. We've just had so much trouble with the chat rooms today. It's okay. Let's see if I can get into one or both and see if there are questions or comments. And of course, you can email questions or comments at to comment at spingola.com. And anyway, alrighty. Don't see any questions. Alrighty. Let's talk about the FDA Modernization Act of 1997. But first, let me remind you about U.S. Code Chapter 32, which is the Chemical and Biological Warfare Program, which actually allows the government to, use human subjects for testing of chemical or biological agents. And this is U.S. Code number 1520A, and the Secretary of Defense, let me just read a few comments here. The Secretary of Defense may not conduct directly or by contract any test or experiment involving the use of a chemical agent or biological agent on a civilian population or any other testing of a chemical agent or biological agent on human subjects, except when subject to subsections C, D, and E of this section, the prohibition in subsection A of this section does not apply to a test or experiment carried out for any of the following: any peaceful purpose that is related to a medical, therapeutic, pharmaceutical, agricultural, industrial, or research activity; any purpose that is directly related to protection against toxic chemicals or biological weapons and agents; 3, any law enforcement purpose, including any purpose related to riot control; and C, the Secretary of Defense may conduct, and remember who was the Secretary of Defense? Was Rumsfeld during that period of time, where all of these people got the flu vaccine, Tamiflu. The Secretary of Defense may conduct a test or experiment described in subsection B of this section only if informed consent to the testing was obtained from each human subject in advance of the testing on that subject. Now, informed consent means that, and you can read all of this stuff in this law. Informed consent means essentially that if a chemical is dangerous or might be dangerous, well, any chemical that people take, any patient should be informed before they consent to take anything or to be tested for anything or to take part in a clinical trial. I mean, that's informed consent is imperative. Okay, so let's take a look at the FDA Modernization Act of 1997, which legalized drug testing on children. Now, this was during the Clinton administration's National Partnership for Reinventing Government. We'll pick it up on the other side of the break. Be right back. All righty. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for Clint Richardson, and we are talking about, now we're going to talk a little bit about the FDA Modernization Act of 1997, and legalized the drug testing on children, and of course, these children were not, the parents of these children were not allowed to give their informed consent. They were not told that that the things that the children were going to be using or whatever. There's some fool out there making a lot of noise in my front yard or next door, I don't know. Okay, I'll try and close the window here during the next break. But anyway, I hope it's not too awful. Anyway, during the Clinton administration's National Partnership for Reinventing Government, Congressman Richard Burr and Senator James F. Jeffords sponsored a bill that legislators passed as the FDA Regulatory Modernization Act of 1997, which Clinton signed into law on November 21st, 1997, which took effect on April 1st, 1999. This effectively... Okay, it sounds okay. Alrighty, so it's not a big issue. Okay, it's just bothering me. Alrighty, this effectively resulted in decreasing the time. Okay, we're gonna decrease the time even more so that all these people that the drug industry is paying to evaluate the drug trials wouldn't have to spend as much time in reviewing the new pharmaceutical drugs. And also, this effectively resulted in decreasing the time that it would require for the review and approval of new pharmaceutical drugs from 30 months to 15 months. Senators Spencer Abraham, Daniel Coats, Christopher J. Dodd, Majority Leader, William H. Frist, and Chuck Hagel introduced the bill in the Senate. Now, William H. Frist used to be a doctor who specialized in organ transplantation. So he's one of the guys if you signed one of the donor cards and you signed up to be a donor, then he was one of the guys that would cut you open while you were still alive. If you've listened to any of the programs that I've done with Dr. Byrne, Paul Byrne, and Bernice Jones, you recognize that donating your kidneys or your whatever, being an organ donor, you are signing up to be murdered, okay? And he was one of the guys, as an organ donation, an organ transplant doctor, he was one of the guys that got to do this to you. Just a little side note. This law allows increased patient access to experimental drugs and eliminates the prohibition of broadcasting by manufacturers of information about unapproved uses of drugs. Now, keep in mind that doctors may use drugs that have been approved for off-label uses. You can go in for a soccer injury, and they can give you Prozac. Okay, we will be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel. Who treat you, diet you, treat you like cattle. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men. Machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machine.
We are back, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I have the pleasure of subbing for Clint Richardson on the Corporation Nation. His websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. And do look at the RBN website where there is a tribute to Michael Collins Piper. And we had a tribute program to him last night. So I hope that that you had a chance to listen to that. Or you can listen to it in the archives. We have two chat rooms open tonight, corporationnation.chatango.com and spingola.chatango.com. We will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443. And I did say that we would take them in the second hour, so let's just check and see if there are some phone calls. No, we don't have any. So let's get back to this Modernization Act, which would allow anything. In support of the Modernization Act, on October 7th, 1998, Dr. Michael Friedman testified before a House subcommittee advocating the testing of drugs on children. And he stated, and I quote, "Very few prescription medications approved for marketing in this country are studied, let alone approved for use in pediatric populations," unquote. Companies test their drugs, and I quote, "solely in adult populations," unquote, which Dr. Friedman finds, quote unquote, "particularly troubling because children metabolize drugs differently, experience different side effects and toxicities than adults. For several years, the FDA has encouraged a policy change that would allow drug testing on children so that the drug companies could add pediatric uses on drug labels. The FDA Modernization Act of 1997, Section 111, permits the FDA to request pediatric studies by drug companies and subsequent pediatric labeling for a drug. They just want more patients, more people to take more of their darn drugs. Okay, it has nothing whatsoever to do with treating people. With curing people, and the drug industry does not seem to understand that people have an inherent ability. Their bodies have an inherent ability to heal themselves. It's called the immune system. Okay? And the immune system kicks in and it does a really good job. Unless, of course, you've had a bunch of vaccines, you've had a bunch of pediatric drugs, a bunch of other garbage food, and other things foisted upon you by profit-producing corporations. Okay, per Section 111, the Secretary, by May 20th, 1998, after, and I quote, "consultation with experts, experts in pediatric research, unquote, was to publish a list of approved drugs that might benefit the pediatric population. On March 16, 1998, the FDA published its draft in the Federal Register after obtaining feedback from the AAP, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which is PHRMA, the National Institutes of Health, the Pediatric Pharmacology Research Units Network, the PPRU, and the National Pharmaceutical Alliance, the Generic Pharmaceutical Industry Association, the National Association of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers, and the United States Pharmacopoeia, the USP. The FDA established the final list on May 20th, 1998. On June 29th, 1998, the FDA issued guidelines to the drug industry on how to qualify for pediatric exclusivity. Previously, the FDA had issued, and I quote, written request for pediatric studies for several drugs, unquote. Now, most people have never heard of the PPRU network. Sumner J. Yaffe, Y-A-F-F-E, the author of Neonatal and Pediatric Pharmacology, Therapeutic Principles and Practice, which came out in 2010, was director of the NIH's Center for Research for Mothers and Children for 20 years, from 1980 to 2000. After World War II, when he was in an Army intelligence unit, the Office of Strategic Services, he studied pharmacology at Harvard. Harvard is the very same university that decided, that got together 13 people in 1968-69 and decided that they were going to create a new category of death called brain death so that they could start harvesting organs because, well, with everybody's bodies falling apart with all of this garbage that we're forced to ingest and all of the, well, the livers that are failing and the kidneys that are failing and all the other failing vital organs, well, this was just a great, great new profitable industry. Holy cow. Okay, let's take Ken from West Virginia. Ken.
Yeah, welcome. Kent, Deanna.
Kent. I'm sorry, it says Ken.
Yeah. That was a wonderful Kent. Tribute last night. Very, very nice. And you're talking about Bill Frist. He was a senator. When he was a
yes.
senator, his family is big. They're big into this HCA, Hospital Corporation of America, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're talking about corruption, while he was senator, the Hospital Corporation of America had to pay back the government $745 million for Medicaid fraud allegations. So you can imagine what they got away with, you know, if they paid back $745 million. And here he was a senator, so that tells you what the you know, I'm sure he wasn't doing anything to crack down on the, you know, the Medicaid fraud. And although I looked it up on the internet, I can't find anything about it, you know, with a cursory search. But it seems to me about 15 or 20 years ago, I heard about this HCA, and they were going to take an aggressive approach towards, like, heart transplants. I think they were going to do, like, 100 of them for free or something, or, you know, but in order, they were going to more or less corner the market on heart transplants. They were going to be the go-to people for heart transplants. So,
well, Frist was nominated as the most corrupt politician in the Senate or in Congress.
Yeah, well, that's a good example. I think he was.
If the government is going to make an organization pay back that many millions of dollars, that's just pocket change to the money that they're actually making.
Yeah, yeah. And I always thought that was funny. He was a sitting senator. I'm sure he didn't pound his fist on his desk in the Senate there, demanding, that the government tighten their belt or anything when it comes to paying HCA, fraudulent overcharges and everything.
Oh, exactly.
I just had that comment. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Kent. All righty, we will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443. All righty. Now, most people have never heard of some of these agencies. They have no idea about how people have gone from working in Army intelligence and working with the Office of Strategic Services, and then they go on to work in the medical field or to work in, well, in other areas that have to do with the new medical legislation, the Affordable Health Care Act. And, if you look at all this history and look at all of the behind-the-scenes kind of stuff that is going on in the medical industry, you're going to have a different view of things altogether. Okay, in 1954, after graduating from the University of Vermont, Yaffe received a Fulbright Fellowship and went to London. While at the NIH, he promoted a research network devoted to pediatric pharmacology and is regarded as the father of pediatric clinical pharmacology. Excuse me. Yaffe was an aggressive, and I quote, advocate for the study of drugs in children, unquote. In 1990, the IOM, and I have to look at my other list here to see what IOM is. I believe it's, excuse me, I have a list of all of the, things that I use a lot of abbreviations, and then you have all these abbreviations, and then you forget exactly what they stand for. So, IOM, Institute of Medicine. Okay, I want to make sure I give this all correctly. Okay, so Yaffe was an aggressive advocate for the study of drugs in children. In 1990, the Institute of Medicine sponsored the Forum on Drug Development, a seminar to, and I quote, address the serious issue of the lack of pediatric labeling, unquote. Yaffe was, and I quote, instrumental in convening the key stakeholders, NICHD, the FDA, the pharmaceutical companies, and academia to thoughtfully address this long-standing omission, which means, doggone, we've got a bunch of people here that we're not giving drugs to. We have all these adults that are taking drugs, and look at this other group of people. They're not on any drugs at all. We're missing out on a lot of money, people. So, the IOM suggested the creation of, number one, incentives to promote innovator-sponsored labeling drug studies for earlier in the drug development process, and number two, a network of earlier in the drug development process, and number two, a network of pediatric pharmacology research units. In other words, let's get a bunch of units, get them working in several of these academic facilities so that we can get more people on drugs. We're missing out on all these kids. We need to get these kids on drugs. The earlier, the better. Okay. Karen in Minnesota, welcome.
Yeah. I feel for you. I think you're suffering the effects of chemtrails, a.k.a. geoengineering.
Well, right this minute, there's a noxious smell coming in my open window. I think it's my next-door neighbor who might be putting... He's probably putting Roundup on his front yard or some noxious thing. Because up until all that sound was going on, I was just fine. But although chemtrails, that's definitely a possibility.
Absolutely.
We're all suffering something.
If you listen for the planes and after the planes, then you have the problems.
Sure.
The only other thing I wanted to say was the only solution to the corruptness, the mafia that's running our government, is to wipe them out. We need a Mossad. We need a hit squad. And then they won't run for office anymore, because when they see they're gone, they won't want to take their place.
Well,
that's the only solution.
That's interesting, but I'm not going to say a yay
or nay.
That's
all I have to say, because I know I'll be banned. Goodbye.
Why would you be banned? I'm not going to ban you. Okay. Now, Yaffe, and I do invite your calls at 800-313-9443. All righty. It was his crowning achievement, okay? He was the chair of the AAP's Committee on Drugs. Now, what does the AAP stand for? Let me just look at my little list here. AAP stands for American Academy of Pediatrics. So you have this American Academy of Pediatrics, who are supposed to be watching out for the children in this country. And you have at the head of this group a doctor whose crowning achievement was the development of the pediatric pharmacology research units, and he was the chair of the AAP's Committee on Drugs. Talk about a conflict of interest. In 1994, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, the NICHD, and the National Institutes of Health founded the Pediatric Pharmacology Research Units Network, which functioned until 2010 as a, and I quote, platform for pediatric clinical trials. One of the more than dozen units was at Yale University in New Haven under the direction of Dr. William V. Tamberlane. Per the FDA Modernization Act of 1997, FDA-appointed experts were to evaluate the extent of mercury in several drugs. What that expert found even shocked him. He discovered that by 6 months of age, according to the childhood vaccine schedule, doctors shot 187.5 micrograms of mercury into an infant's body. That is at least 40% more than what the Environmental Protection Agency guidelines suggest. This law, the FDA Modernization Act, FDAMA, also allows and even encourages manufacturers to use children, including infants, to test patented drugs. the government even provides financial incentives to do this testing. Three children perished after they were given a heartburn medicine made by Janssen Pharmaceuticals. What child has heartburn? Why would you give a heartburn medicine to three little kids? Unbelievable. Vaccine makers responded to a December 1998 and April 1999 memo from the FDA regarding its request for thimerosal information. The AAP and the USPHS, referring to the FDAMA, the FDA Modernization Act of 1997, said in their joint response, and I quote, "Nevertheless, because any potential risk is of concern, the United States Public Health Service, the USPHS, the AAP, and vaccine manufacturers agree that thimerosal-containing vaccine should be removed as soon as possible." Similar conclusions were reached this year in a meeting attended by European regulatory agencies, the European vaccine manufacturers, and the U.S. FDA, which examined the use of thimerosal-containing vaccines produced or sold in European countries. The USPHS and the AAP, working collaboratively to ensure that the replacement of thimerosal-containing vaccines takes place as expeditiously as possible, while at the same time ensuring that our high vaccination coverage levels and their associated low disease levels throughout our entire childhood population are maintained, unquote. While they would willingly accept any change in the composition of the vaccines, they really saw no reason to make any change, evidenced by another comment in their joint statement that said, and I quote, "There is a significant safety margin incorporated into all the acceptable mercury exposure limits. Furthermore, there are no data or evidence of any harm caused by the level of exposure that some children may have encountered in following the existing immunization schedule. Infants and children who have received thimerosal-containing vaccines do not need to be tested for mercury exposure," unquote. So, it didn't matter that these children were receiving 187.5 micrograms of mercury as infants. Didn't make any difference. They weren't going to test them for mercury exposure. They would ultimately take the mercury out of the vaccine, I believe in 2001. But they still prepare vaccines with mercury, and instead of having mercury in the vaccines, they put aluminum in the vaccines. And they also still put mercury in all flu vaccines, which many government agencies, the CDC, and even state agencies mandate that children 6 months and older have flu shots. And in fact, New York has made it mandatory that anybody that is in daycare or anybody that is in any kind of social situation must have a flu shot when they're 6 months old or older. And pregnant women also need to have this mercury-filled flu shot, even when they're pregnant. Wow. All right. We will take your phone calls at 800-313-9443. All righty. Tipper Gore, with a B.A. in psychology, was President Bill Clinton's mental health advisor for his health care task force, the architects for the health care reform proposals. Gore said, and I quote, "Why should a woman with diabetes who needs insulin have it covered by insurance, whereas a woman with manic depressive illness who needs lithium not be covered in the same way when both diseases can be managed and controlled?" Unquote. Well, there's a major difference between a person who is diabetic, who may need insulin, which is debatable in and of itself, and have it covered by insurance, where a person, a woman, with manic depressive illness, which there are no biological tests for, there's no biological test for any mental disease. None. People have said, oh, they're chemically depressed. Their brain is, they're manufacturing too much chemicals. They're chemically unbalanced. Well, the only way to test the chemical components or the chemical balances in the brain is if you're dead and you have an autopsy, okay? But what they were trying to do under the Clinton administration is to get everything that you could possibly go to a doctor for, whether it was mental, physical, whatever, they wanted the insurance companies to cover it. Now, this was big time profitable news for the insurance industry, as well as for the pharmaceutical industry, because a lot of people, since World War II, since insurance became a big part of a person's job, they wanted to make certain that there were more patients, that the pharmaceutical industry could put out more pills, prescribe more pills, provided they were covered by insurance, which is a very, very, very big deal. Alrighty, the American Psychological Association, according to the Los Angeles Times, claimed that 18% of Americans, including 14 million children, suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder, and that 1 in 5 Americans will, and I quote, experience at least one episode of major depression during their lifetimes, unquote. Well, listeners, we all get depressed. We all are happy. We're all depressed. We're all sad. We're all a lot of stuff. Okay, we're going to a break. Be back in 3 minutes. This is Deanna. I am subbing for Clint tonight and tomorrow night. It's been a joy to do that. Anyway, in 1993, the government claimed that, and I quote, "Mental health treatment costs about $147 billion a year," unquote, out of the nation's $700 billion annual health care bill. And as I was talking before we went to the break, the DSM, which is the diagnoses, let me just give it to you correctly here. Let me look at my my list. The DSM, you get so used to calling it something, and then you forget what it is that it stands for. The DMS is Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Okay, that first came into being in 1952 after the war, and after the psychiatry industry went to Congress and said, give us so many millions of dollars and we will fix society. We're going to fix society really well. So they created the DSM, and they literally made up things that they could call mental disorders. And it was a bunch of psychiatrists that got together, and they voted on what they could classify as a mental disorder. And what they would do was medicalized every human characteristic. If you were shy, well, there's something for, they would call it sad. If you were going through, everybody gets depressed, okay? I get depressed once in a while. Does that mean I have to go to a doctor and take a pill? No! It means I talk to my friends, I work things out, I go for a walk, we work out, as we have for hundreds of years, we work out these problems with our family, with our friends, we work them out. If you're overly happy, well, there's something for that too. If you have a little bit of anxiety, if you're going to give a speech in front of a bunch of people and you suffer anxiety, or if you have to get up in school and give a report and you're a little nervous, well, it's natural, people. You don't take a pill for everything unless the pharmaceutical industry sees you as a target group. We're all targets for this industry. Okay, in addition to the vaccine issues regarding children, there were also the mental health issues. On June 8th, 1999, the Gores and the Clintons, and of course the Clinton family had been, well, they've been trafficking illegal drugs through that certain airport down in Georgia. And so it wasn't as if these people had nothing to do with drugs before they became, what, legitimate representatives or politicians. Anyway, on June 8, 1999, the Gores and the Clintons promoted the use of psychiatric drugs during the first White House conference on mental health. And this was White House Conference on Mental Health, Howard University in Washington, D.C., chaired by Tipper Gore. The drug industry financed NAMI. Advertised it. Let me tell you what NAMI stands for. NAMI stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness, and it is funded by the drug industry. Most of those organizations, even though they pretend to be grassroots, they are all funded by the drug industry. Okay, the drug industry financed NAMI, advertised it for, and I quote, consumers, advocates, researchers, business and medical professionals to discuss mental health issues that affect over 50 million Americans, quote, unquote. Now we've got 50 million Americans who absolutely need to take a psych drug. Let's give these people what they need, for goodness sake. In addition to C-SPAN covering the event live, NAMI hoped that, and I quote, over 1,000 satellite downlink sites across the country would broadcast. During her remarks at the conference, good old Hillary Clinton said, and I quote, "This is an historic conference, but it is more than that. It's a real signal to our nation that we must do whatever it takes, not only to remove the stigma from mental illness, but to begin treating mental illness as the illness it is on a parity with other illnesses," unquote. She then referred to her days at Yale, and I quote, "When I was a young law student working at the Child Study Center at the Yale University and taking classes at the med school and working at the Yale New Haven Hospital and very interested in the intersection of mental illness and the law and in the development of children and other issues that we were only then just beginning to address," unquote. Isn't that wonderful that she is taking such a wide interest in helping these little children to get on drugs? She then introduced Dr. Stephen E. Hyman, then the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, the NIMH, now a member of the IOM Governing Council, Institute of Medicine Governing Council, who said, and I quote, this is Hyman speaking, "The World Bank and the World Health Organization have recognized that depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide, including the United States," unquote. Yep, he said that. Now that brings up another something that we need to talk about. This trade treaty, the TPP, will, if passed, eventually morph into a close-knit international collective of government agencies that collaborate on medical drug safety. Translation: the U.S. FDA and Health Canada and the Australian TGA and the New Zealand MedSafe and the medical regulatory agencies of Singapore, Vietnam, Brunei, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, and Peru will declare dangerous drugs to be safe. Together, on behalf of the corporations who manufacture them, when a massive global agency like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, is actually when this massive global agency like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, is actually a criminal organization, it enjoys special benefits, not the least of which is freedom from prosecution. Now, this came from John Rappaport, and he has a website, johnrappaport.wordpress.com, and he made mention of this just recently. So, you have the TPP, you have the World Bank, and the World Health Organization, who, under Hyman, 1997 stated that the World Bank and the World Health Organization have recognized that depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide, including the United States. Yes, he said the World Bank. The World Bank, excuse me, and the NIMH organized the seminar, Mental Health and the Global Development Agenda. What role for the World Bank? That they held, okay, they held the seminar on November 24th through the 25th, 2003, at the World Bank headquarters in Washington, D.C. One of the topics of discussion for that conference was, and I quote, mental health programming for low and middle income countries, unquote. Now, if you look back at the opium wars that were in China, if you look at any country that has a bunch of people on drugs, drugs are for control of your population. The more people they can get on mind-altering drugs, the more they can control the population. And the more money that the pharmaceutical drug industry is going to make. Now, Hyman was a Yale graduate, has worked to increase the psychiatric classifications in the DSM. Clinton then said, and I'm talking about good old Hillary, she said, and I quote, so how then has these scientific discoveries, they're not scientific discoveries, okay, people? There's no science about it. None, none, nada, nothing. They aren't scientific. There's something that a bunch of psychiatrists got together and made up. So, but Clinton said, and I quote, so how then has these scientific discoveries changed the way that we as a society deal with mental illness? If you, as experts and practitioners, know that we should treat mental illness as real and as treatable as a disease of a bodily part, namely the brain, what does that mean for the kind of response that we should be looking to in society, unquote. Hyman responded, if I could just, and this is a quote, if I can just encapsulate them briefly, it's that these are real illnesses of a real organ, the brain. Just like coronary artery disease is a disease of a real organ, the heart. We can make diagnoses, and these diseases are treatable. In addition, we've learned that these diseases should be treated just like general medical disorders. Unquote. Following Hyman's remarks, Clinton said, and I quote, I'm also very pleased that in July, under your leadership, the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, will launch a $7.3 million landmark study to determine the nature of mental illness and treatments. This will be a study that will help us guide strategies and policies for the next century by collecting information on mental illness, including the prevalence and duration of it, as well as the types of treatments that are most commonly used. NIMH will announce the launch of two new clinical trials, investing a total of $61 million to build effective treatments for those affected by mental illness, unquote. Now, if you were to go online and take a survey, and there's a lot of surveys online, and they're making surveys part of the school system, they can test your kid and see if they have a mental illness. Well, anybody that fills out a survey is going to have a mental illness. It doesn't matter who you are. If you fill out a survey, you're going to be diagnosed as having a mental illness. Okay? On July 7th, 1999, Hillary Clinton, the only First Lady to ever run for a political office, officially announced that she was seeking the U.S. Senate seat for New York. Excuse me. The Clintons then quickly purchased a house in Chappaqua, north of New York City. During her campaign, she endorsed biological psychiatry and the use of psychiatric drugs. I bet she collected a lot of financing from the pharmaceutical industry. Her time in the Senate would also make her appear as a legitimate politician, which is akin to saying an honest thief. Okay, we're going for a break. We will be right back.
What the object is all about.
Information.
All righty, we are back, and we have a caller, Andrea in Oklahoma. Andrea, welcome.
Yes, today, Michael Rivera had a caller call in, and the school that his daughter's going to has been, they're wanting to give Gardasil shots to the girls, and, he's just like panicked because he knows that he doesn't want his daughter having it. And what, Michael, he kind of brainstormed last night and put together a piece of paper. It's called the Vaccine Liability Contract for Medical Practitioners. If a practitioner really truly believes that their products are safe and effective, they should not have any reason not to sign this agreement, which is a direct contract and bypass the indemnification of the Homeland Security if the practitioner does hesitate or outright refuses to sign. Then you have all the proof you need that the shot being prescribed is not safe and that the practitioner knows it. So maybe we can bypass all these laws, and when a woman goes in and she's pregnant with a baby, or if she's just given birth to a child, she can produce. I mean, of course, this is just people that know about what, if they put this together, maybe we the people might be able, imano imano, one-on-one, with our doctors, say, look, either you do this or we're not going through with it, and maybe we can make a difference that way. We've just got to do something. Let's talk. It's all these laws upon laws upon laws, layers upon layers. And it just, I think it scares people to death, and they just go through, because I have a grandchild, and it's scaring me to death that all these little children are getting all this, and it's like, I know that there's papers out there that you can fight it, and I know that the people that have fought it, the government comes after them, and they're trying to swipe the children. Well, we've got to do something.
Yes, I've had a lot of people on my programs who've had their children seized, and there are certain exemptions, but they're taking away the religious exemption in some states. It's almost impossible to get a medical exemption, and the only exemption left is the philosophical one. And certainly that paper is available. I believe that Dr. Rebecca Carley produced a letter or a paper that said, okay, if you want to sign this, doctor, we'll go ahead with what you want to do. But any doctor that is licensed is actually protected by the standard of care, which perhaps we'll be talking about tomorrow night, because I'm going to pick this up tomorrow night and talk more about the laws that have been put into effect and the way that these are going to be impacting our country, every single one of us. We need to wake up to the events and wake up to what is going on and the causes and consequences that certain events have had on the health care of every single solitary person in this country.
I love you, Deanna. I'm with that other lady earlier that says we need to do something with our politicians, like, you know, what she said. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We need to take responsibility for our own health care and stay the heck away from doctors, okay? That's the first recommendation to be safe. Stay the heck away from doctors. Okay, thank you so much for joining me tonight, and we'll talk tomorrow night when I will be back on the Corporation Nation. Take care. Thank you.